Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment with his family, this being the holidays and all. And in fact, our producer and editor, what an extraordinary guy, Jamie, just to let you guys know, he worked for some years in radio aboard a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier. So they have radio stations in those things. It's like a floating city. And he won awards, and he's just a real pro, and it's an honor to have Jamie as part of the Real Science Radio crew. So with Fred gone and Jamie gone, we've got a board operator, and we thought we would take a call. We got an email from a listener back east. In fact, it's a young guy, and he had questions about the sloth. There's the extinct ground sloth, and then there's two different kinds of sloths. And a question about that and other creatures. So what I did is I went to our homepage, rsr.org, Real Science Radio, so rsr.org, and I used the custom search at the top of rsr.org, and I just put in sloths, and sure enough, there are these fabulous articles from creation websites. So it's a custom search where instead of just using Google, this is powered by Google, but it only searches the leading creation websites. So it saves hours for me in my work. It saves me hours every month, and it could save you, help you get to the information that you want more quickly. It also includes results, of course, from our own website, rsr.org. So I reviewed an article on sloths, and now what an honor it is to talk with Nathan. Nathan from Georgia. Nathan, welcome to Real Science Radio.
Hello, thank you. So, yes, I did have a question on ground sloths, and I was just wondering if you could address that in this radio show.
Well, sure thing, Nathan. Why don't you say what your question is about sloths? And I was told you had questions on other issues regarding evolution, so maybe you could name a couple of those, and then we'll get to them.
Sure thing. Other than the ground sloth, I was wondering about the Archaeopteryx, the extinct bird, and I was wondering about its beak. Does it have a beak, first off? And that makes me wonder because, you know, all birds have beaks.
Okay.
And then I also have a question on, you know, like apes. Why do they see in the same color vision we do, and why not any other animals? And that's about it for right now. And then also camels and llamas, how that could diversify. How can you get a camel from a llama? With the hump on its back.
All right, so these are great questions. So let's start with sloths. There's a kid's movie, an animated movie about sloths sometime recently, and how slowly they move. And in real life, they move very slowly. Let's say they want to go, like, say, 45 feet. It could take them about an hour to go 45 feet. So that's pretty funny. But then, what is your question about this creature? I love how they could look like climbing up a tree. It could look like they have a lawn on their back, like their whole body is grass. It could look like that,
yeah.
But they have this rough hair that has a fungus in it that gives them that greenish lawn grass-like look for part of the year. So, so what is your question about sloths?
So how can they diversify in a sense, like in such little amounts of time? And not only how do they diversify, but in such little amounts of time, but like how do they diversify in general? Like how can they do that? Like when I'm looking at a normal sloth today, you know, they're all in the trees and all, and then the ground sloths, they were on the ground. So in a way, it seems like evolution occurred, even though I don't agree with that idea. It kind of just confuses me.
Yeah, sure. Okay. There are two kinds of living sloths, and then they're the extinct ground sloths, right? And the two living ones, the two different genera of sloths, they're distinguished by their front limbs, right? How many toes they have. They both have three toes on their back limbs, but then you have the two-toed sloths and the three-toed sloths. So one genus has two toes, the other genus, and their four limbs, the other genus has three toes. That's the two groups, right? And within those groups, you have subspecies. And so then you go back to the ground sloth, which was a lot larger. These things, they like to live their whole lives in trees. They hang upside down. In fact, they've even been found dead. They've died, and they're still hanging up there. So whereas the ground sloths are much larger, and they could be the largest ones, they went extinct during the Ice Age, round about then, about the size of the largest ones like an elephant, and then some that are smaller, maybe half that size. Okay, so the question is, how do you end up with these three different groups based on the creation model? So let me ask first about the evolution model. What do the evolutionists say about how you get these different groups of sloths? Are you familiar with their claim?
So their claim is basically, if I remember correctly in science textbooks, what they basically are they're the ground creatures. But what happens is they slowly become tree climbers, basically. So like they gradually start to, like, their limbs start to shorten, basically, and then they become tree climbers.
So they evolve their arboreal existence after first walking around on the ground, and so that's their story. Okay, so, Nathan, the two groups, the two existing groups, the two-toed and the three-toed living sloths, when evolutionists look at them, they look at their anatomy, their phylogeny, they come up with a hypothesis that they say both groups are more closely related to the ground sloth than they are to each other.
Yes.
So they don't say that you had the ground sloth and then the three-toed group evolved out of that and then the two-toed group evolved out of that sideways. They don't say that. They say that you had the ground sloths and then independently two separate species or genuses of sloths evolved in parallel evolution, making the most uncanny, identical evolutionary changes. And now that, this is typical when you look at the theory of evolution, when you look at it with a broad brush, it sounds like what they're saying is reasonable. When you look at it in more detail, you find out how in the world would these two groups evolve the astounding similarities in just a random and parallel way. So let's make an analogy first with shrews, right? Shrews, rodents, and then we'll go back to the sloths.
Okay.
So have you heard of the elephant shrew?
I have in my science textbook in middle school.
Oh, in middle school. So what, can I ask you what grade you're in or how old are you, Nathan?
I am 14, and I am in ninth grade.
Ninth grade. Fabulous. What an honor. How'd you find out about Real Science Radio? I got a note here in my Gmail. I think I know, but how did you find us?
Yes. So how I found out about Real Science Radio was there's this other YouTube channel called CBC Media, and basically, I mean, they're really big, apparently, but one of y'all's videos was on their channel, so I guess they took one of y'all's videos.
Yes.
So I ended up finding out about you guys that way. So I searched up your name and I found out about Real Science Radio that way.
Yes. In fact, they took our video called Jurassic, which documents the soft tissue, like the red blood cells and blood vessels they're finding in the bones of Hadrosaur and T-Rex. They're even finding DNA, the double helix of dinosaurs. And this is all being published in the world's leading science journals. So they took our video and they used excerpts from it. In fact, it includes segments where I was debating Lawrence Krauss, one of the world's leading atheists, and one of the world's leading atheist evolutionists, Jack Horner, involved with the Jurassic Park films. And so that I'm so thrilled that they bootlegged that stuff, Nathan, because that way we got to meet you and about 700,000 other people have heard that powerful evidence showing that dinosaurs are young, all of them, So that's really cool.
I think it's awesome.
Okay, so shrews, these rodents, they're pretty small. They're rodents. But there's one of them called an elephant shrew. So why do they call it an elephant shrew?
Well, you had a really long snout, so that's the biggest reason why they would call it an elephant
shrew. Sure, you look at it, and it looks like maybe the cutest elephant you'd ever see in your life, only it's a little rodent.
Uh-huh.
And so the evolutionist, it's been called an elephant shrew for a long time. Recently, they sequenced its genome, its DNA, and the evolutionists were shocked to find out what they did. It turns out that the elephant shrew, its genome, its DNA, is closer to elephants than it is to other shrews. Now, that's shocking.
Because, it is very shocking.
Yes, because if you're creating a Charles Darwin-type tree of life to see what evolved from what, then you have a real dilemma. Did this shrew evolve from another shrew and decide to grow a long snout? Or did this shrew evolve from an elephant? Or did the elephant evolve from this shrew, right? It's all, it turns out when you look at the details, it's all wildly absurd. And so what we realize as creationists, that God had a genetic toolbox, if you will. And from that genetic toolbox, he could design microbes, fungi, reptiles, birds. He could create shrews. He could create sloths. And with his creativity, if he wants to put features of one animal into another, he has every motivation to do that if it's enjoyable to him and if it's physically possible. So when God created the sloths, we could ask the question, what was the original created kind? Was it the current living sloths that the ground sloth was an adaptation of? In other words, responding to the environment. Or did he create the ground sloth and the two current living groups of sloths are an adaptation? Or did he create all three groups of sloths?
And that's a big question.
Yes, and one way to investigate that is to see if there has been any research in trying to get reproduction between the two-toed and the three-toed sloths. And as far as I know, that hasn't been done yet. And even if it has been done and failed, that wouldn't be necessarily definitive. But there are creatures that we know have incredible genetic adaptability built into them where they respond to the environment very rapidly, not after 1,000 generations, but in one generation or in a couple generations. I'll give you examples. If there are fish in a pond and they have no predators, then biologists studying them have learned that they will produce a small number of eggs, and those eggs will mature slowly. When you introduce a predator, then the same fish, the same species, they get a genetic switch that's thrown, and then from then on out, that species will produce a higher number of eggs, and they'll mature more quickly in order to try to survive. So what's interesting is that didn't take thousands of generations. It was a pre-programmed adaptation to a challenge from the environment.
Right. So are we looking at like the different characteristics of these three sloths then?
Yes, we could look at their abilities and consider whether those abilities were being expressed from when these creatures were first created or whether they had innate genetic variation that then expressed itself as they meet the opportunity, like the fish that are in a cave and they're blind. Have you heard about that kind of fish?
I have, the blind cave fish.
What have you learned about that?
So when you have a blind fish, it's just normal fish, and you put them in a cave for so long, it would be more beneficial, I guess, loss of information or mutation for them to lose that ability to see. But then once they're placed into like just right after a few generations even, they're put back into a bright environment again. Their eyes come right back.
That's astounding. So what's happening, we could see, is that there are genetic responses. An ability could become recessive. It could look like it all but disappeared. And then you put the organism, the species, in an environment where that ability could be helpful, and that genetic ability reappears. It didn't evolve de novo. It was there. We have information loss through mutations, and we have species of fish where you keep killing the larger fish. Like in trying to manage our fisheries, the Darwinists for many decades have told fishermen that you can only keep the big fish. If you catch a little fish, you got to throw it back. And so it turns out that that has decimated some population of some species of fish, where we now only have smaller versions of those fish because the genes for larger fish have been lost, and they've actually stopped fishing altogether certain species, hoping for the big fish to come back, and they haven't come back.
Oh, wow.
So it's possible that you could lose genetic information permanently, or something could become recessive. Even the chromosomes could change quickly, not over millions of years, but quickly, so that a feature is no longer being expressed because it doesn't help the organism.
Right, and I see that a lot in different types of creatures too. Like if you look at dragonflies back, like think dragonflies, they were really huge. And then like once the atmospheric pressures changed, and that could very well have been from Noah's flood, you know, the dragonflies obviously became smaller, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Well, yeah, and that's a great question. We have an open research project at Real Science Radio. We have a Monday night, every Monday night, we have a few guys on a research team, and we meet over Google Hangouts. And it's a way to fund our ongoing broadcast. It costs a lot to do RSR. And so the guys will actually pay as a fundraiser to keep us on the air $25 per week. And every Monday night we have this video conference. And one of our projects is to document all the evidence for higher atmospheric pressure and for higher oxygen content.
Yes.
And we want to first get all the evidence for that, and then look at the creation explanations for that. And for example, are you familiar with the hydroplate theory, the fountains of the great deep model of the global flood?
I am. In fact, you know, there was this other theory that Answers in Genesis has with the plate tectonics, but, you know, I like that hydroplate theory a lot more.
Well, yeah, we've come to the same conclusion. The catastrophic plate tectonics guys, we love them dearly as brothers in the Lord. And Nathan, I'm assuming you're a Christian. Do you believe in Jesus Christ? Do you trust him?
Yes, I do.
Oh, that's just so encouraging to hear. So, hey, we could hang out. We could meet in heaven for coffee once a month. So, our dear friends who are with AIG or CMI or ICR, the initials, you know, CRS, they think that the ones who support the catastrophic plate tectonics, they think that the fountains of the great deep were magma. It was lava. Yeah. And we think that that's completely false, that it's evident from Genesis that the fountains of the great deep were water. It was the water below the firmament that broke forth, the water from the great deep. And so if the fountains of the great deep model of the global flood, the hydroblade theory, is correct, then that water came up from 60 miles below the surface with such tremendous energy that much of the debris reached escape velocity and left Earth's atmosphere and beat up the moon. The near side of the moon got beat up to a pulp. The far side got sprinkled with craters in comparison. And the asteroids, the meteoroids, the comets, the TNOs out past Neptune, all the dangerous bullets that are flying around the solar system and occasionally hit the Earth, they were not part of the original paradise of the Earth. That's the debris from the global flood. If that's true, then the Earth had maybe a percent or a percent and a half more mass before the flood. And that additional mass might have increased, for example, the oxygen content above the surface of the Earth, pulling the oxygen molecules in the atmosphere tighter to the Earth. So who knows? That's a real interesting question.
It's really interesting. And, you know, like I've heard a lot on that topic in the past. So it is an interesting topic. And I think like a little bit more research is done on it. We might find new things and much more evidence towards the global flooding all through that.
Sure. We have a page on our website, rsr.org/evidence, and it provides the evidence for the global flood for the secular person and the evidence for the global flood for the Christian. So it provides both in two lists. So back to the sloths. So God has a genetic toolbox, and out of this toolbox, he pulls regulatory genes, Hox genes, structural genes, transport proteins, the genes to build those. And he makes all these different kinds of amazing creatures. He'll put the genes for echolocation, not only in a bat, but what other creature has echolocation, Nathan?
There's also dolphins and whales. Or okay. I should say just the whole whale type in general, since dolphins are a break off from the whales, if I'm not mistaken.
If you were to draw an evolutionary tree of what evolved from what based on how many toes, or if it's an even-toed or odd-toed ungulate, or whether or not how many fingers they have on their limbs, or whether or not they have echolocation, you would think that bats evolved from whales, or whales evolved from bats, which of course is absurd. But when you look at the genetic sequence of these two creatures that even the evolutionists, the Darwinists, admit that they did not have a common ancestor that had echolocation. They admit that.
Yeah.
They have a name for that. You know what they call it?
What do they call it?
Convergent evolution, where totally independently, whales and bats evolved the same sequence on their DNA in this extraordinary way. And if that were true, if that were possible, then all the arguments for what evolved from what go out the window, because it all could be parallel evolution, convergent evolution.
Mm-hmm.
But when we see similarities between creatures, it certainly could tell us that there's the same designer. It doesn't have to tell us that one evolved from the other. So with sloths, did God create three kinds or two kinds? And in fact, did the ground sloth adapt from the living sloths, or vice versa? These are questions that have not been fully answered yet, but we could see by the claim of parallel evolution that the Darwinist explanation is unworkable.
It's really absurd. Like, I've studied these things in the textbooks for a very long time. In fact, like my teacher in middle school, she was Catholic, yet she believed in evolution. I'm not Catholic. I am Christian, but you know, like, it's sad how just because, like, the Pope says it or so, it makes it true to the Catholics. It's just sad.
The Vatican has had a Pontifical Academy of Sciences that's been mostly led by atheists. And so they have supported the Big Bang and evolution, these secular models for origins, and it has harmed the ability of millions of people to see the overwhelming evidence for God as the creator. And for those Catholics and others who say they're theistic evolutionists, that they believe that God was involved in evolution, well, the number one claim of evolution is that it was an unguided process. So if God is involved, you can't have a guided, unguided process. That's a total non sequitur. It's inherently contradictory. And guess who loses out? In their model, there's nothing for God to do. It's simply indistinguishable from atheism.
Okay, so I had another question along these lines, too, that my science teacher kind of went over in science class. Going back to the whole bird idea and all, like bird, dinosaur to bird evolution, you know, like how the Archaeopteryx is found in the lower layers of the fossil strata?
All right.
Why is it that no other birds are found with Archaeopteryxes? Why is it only the Archaeopteryx?
Wow. Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure. Generally speaking, when we see the fossils buried in the geologic column, there is a pattern. And so the pattern must be telling us something. There are inconsistencies. For example, there are many living fossils. We have on our website, rsr.org/living fossils, you could find many creatures like the coelacanth, a fish that supposedly went extinct many millions of years ago, and it's still swimming around. And so what that would tell you is that its ancestors would have died in every strata from where they found it in the fossil record right up till today. The same thing with the Willemi pine that I think a pine tree in Australia is supposed to go extinct maybe, I forget the years, you know, maybe 80 million years ago, and they find it still alive. There are many, many living fossils. And then there are other creatures, like if you take a modern shrimp and you compare it to a fossil shrimp, they look identical, but the paleontologists, they give the fossil shrimp a different name. Why do they give it a different name? Because they don't want it to look like it's the same, but they look identical. So for one thing, we got to recognize that while there is a pattern in the deposition of animals and plants in the geologic column, there are significant exceptions. But what we think we see is not the order of development of the tree of life, but rather the order that creatures were buried during the global flood. So that you had all the animals that were created on day 5, day 6, plants on day 3. So they're all alive together from the first week of creation. But they didn't necessarily all live in the same places on the earth. Hey, this is Bob Inyart breaking into my own program. It's so fun talking to Nathan. We had to take his call around his schedule, and then we covered so much material that we had enough for two programs. So I hope you're enjoying this conversation with him as much as I am. And to conclude, I invite you to tune in next week, right here, same time, same channel, at realscienceradio.com or the abbreviated version, rsr.org. Also, check out our store, just rsr.org. Click on the store. You can help us stay on the air by purchasing our science materials or our monthly subscriptions, Bible studies, topical videos, our old BEL televised classics when the program was on TV nationwide, and also the sermons that I preach every Sunday. All of this available on DVD, Blu-ray, audio, video, and downloads. So I'm looking forward to the conclusion of this discussion with Nathan from Georgia. For Fred Williams and Bob Inyart, this is Real Science Radio. May God bless you.